It's another edition of the Falls Cast, brought to you by the Falls Free Press in beautiful Cuyahoga Falls, where today, Monday, October 26th, at about actually 10 in the morning, it is gloomy and a bit wet and, you know, not the most beautiful day, but it is reminding us that fall is here and winter is around the corner. This week, we have decided to forego our roundtable discussion because we are pleased to be able to bring you two different interviews with some folks who are going to be on your ballot if you're in Cuyahoga Falls. We have running for the 36th District State House, Mr. Matt Shaughnessy. He'll be joining us. And we also have the Domestic Relations Court judge candidate, Connie Hightower, who will also be joining us for an interview of her own. We thought since these two candidates would be on the ballot and next week is election day, this would be a good opportunity to allow them to speak directly to our listeners and give you a little bit more information about who they are and what they're running for. So we hope you enjoy these two interviews, and don't forget to get out there and vote. If you have a mail-in ballot, get it filled out, get it returned to the Board of Elections, whether in person with the Dropbox or by mail, make sure it's postmarked on time, and that everything's filled out correctly, and make your voice heard and make sure your vote counts, in this, maybe the most important election of our lifetimes. Even though we say that every time, it seems like it's more and more true every time. So, thanks for listening to the Falls Cast. This is our 21st episode. We're very, very happy that we've been having so many listeners and that we have been able to provide this this content for the members of our community, a community that we love very dearly. So stay tuned for the interviews with Matt Shaughnessy and Connie Hightower, and we will see you next week, I guess right after Election Day. So don't forget to get out there and vote, and we'll see you next week. And we're back on the Falls Cast. We're recording this segment on Sunday, October 25th at about 7:30 p.m. Connie Hightower is a magistrate in the Akron Municipal Court, and she is running for the Summit County Court of Common Pleas Domestic Relations Judge seat that is going to be left vacant by Judge John Quinn, who is retiring after the end of this term. Her opponent, Katarina Cook, is running for the same seat, even though she currently holds a domestic relations judge seat, in hopes that if she were to win, she could take over the seat that Connie is vying for, and the Republican Party would then be allowed to recommend to Governor Mike DeWine a replacement, giving Republicans control of both domestic relations judge seats in the Summit County Court of Common Pleas. Connie was kind enough to join us here on this Sunday evening, and we thank her for doing so. Connie, how's it going?
Good evening. Thank you so much, Alex, for having me. Everything is going well. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Thank you again.
Absolutely. I called you Connie a couple of times, and I feel like I should be saying magistrate.
Either way is fine. It's okay.
Okay, cool. There were a couple of stories that popped up in the Falls News Press today, which serves Cuyahoga Falls. And of course, our podcast is focused on the Cuyahoga Falls community. I know one of them was a reprint from the Akron Beacon Journal. One of them was also just kind of a get to know the candidates piece. And the other one was talking about this situation in which, Judge Cook is, kind of running for this other seat in hopes of, keeping Republican control of both, seats on the bench. So, I thought it was actually good timing that we had planned to do this interview because both of those pieces are going to be timely, for our listeners. Before we talk about all that though, you have a really impressive background and story from your rise in Aurora to where you are now. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us, you know, your story outside of, you know, your run for the bench here. Would you mind doing that?
Sure. Absolutely, Alex. So I grew up in Stowe. I was born in Akron, grew up in Stowe. I went to Stowe from kindergarten through when I graduated high school in 1991. What's interesting about that is I finished high school in 3 years. Typically, it takes 4 years, but...
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, thank you. I dropped all my study halls and said, hey, I can get this done in 3 years, and I graduated in 91 instead of 92. Of course, now we have college classes where people can take college in their last year, but they didn't do that back then. So it was kind of the same thing. So I graduated from Stowe in 1991. Prior to that, while I was in Stowe, I started my community service off as being a Girl Scout. And I was a Girl Scout for a number of years. I did softball and track, so I was a student athlete. And then when I left Stowe, I went to school at Kent State. And at Kent State, I graduated with a bachelor's in English and a minor in paralegal studies, or concentration in paralegal studies. And at that time, I was a single mom. I had my first child, who is now 29, and he and I kind of grew up together during that time.
Wow.
So, thank you. And so when I finished Kent, when I was at Kent, I started working as a clerk of council in Aurora, which is kind of unique because I was appointed four times there to serve four different terms and eventually left to go to law school. And I was the city clerk in Aurora. And so for anybody who doesn't know what that is, you basically manage and run the legislative department of the city or the legislative branch. I worked for nine councilmen at their pleasure. And for that, I was in a politically appointed position. I was a Democrat at the time, but I was appointed by an all Republican, almost all white male council, and they reappointed me four times. And so that was a great experience there.
And a great accomplishment too. Wow.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, I mean, I was finishing college and I had worked at a local law firm in Akron, Retzel and Andrews, for a while. And I decided to apply for that position and I got it. And I only left there to go to law school in 2004 and started law school in 2005. It was kind of interesting because I started law school as a part-time student. So it was a four-year program. Decided to do it as a three-year program because my son was a high school standout athlete at Copley. And I wanted to be able to do the senior visits with him and do what I could so to help him be a collegiate athlete. And so I finished law school in 3 years, helped my son, you know, figure out where he wanted to go. He went to Baldwin Wallace and he played football there. So that was pretty much what I did to graduate from law school. Graduated from Akron Law in 2008. When I did, I was immediately put on the staff as an adjunct professor of law. In fact, I started teaching law prior to even getting my bar results. I passed my bar exam on the first time, and I started teaching at Akron, and I taught at Akron for 11 years up until the time I started deciding to run for office. So that's pretty much my career up until going to law school. When I was a professor there, I also taught people to pass the bar exam, and I volunteered my time in that. Once I started practicing law, I've been practicing for 12 years in the areas of civil, criminal, domestic relations, juvenile, and probate law, as well as appellate law. So I do a lot of brief writing, and I've written briefs for the Ohio Supreme Court. I've also done many jury trials, some high-level criminal trials, as well as high-level civil, as well as lower-end civil and criminal trials as well. And during that time, I've also volunteered heavily with the Akron Bar Association and other drug courts and things of that nature. And then finally, of course, I'm a magistrate at Akron Municipal Court, and I share the docket with another part-time magistrate, Jennifer Towell, and we handle small claims and evictions. So there's my history.
That is an incredible, incredible story. I cannot believe, I mean, just very, very impressive. You know, I had no idea that you had a 29-year-old child. I mean, that's amazing that you did all that while being a mother too. I mean, that's just amazing. So,
well, I thank you. And I should have said during that time I had gotten married and I did have another two children. One is now 15 and one is now 10. So that was my oldest child. I'm still a mom. I'm still raising children and they all go to Copley High School currently. Well, except for the oldest one, the other two, I'm sorry. That's not true. The other two we currently live in Copley. My middle child goes to Hope and my daughter still goes to Copley.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, yeah. We share Kent State, you and me. I got my PhD in English from there. So,
English.
Yeah, I strode the same halls you did. I assume Satterfield Hall.
Absolutely. Satterfield. I thought I was going to be an English professor. I ended up being a law professor, but my father was a professor for almost 50 years. He's now a professor emeritus at Kent State. And so Kent State has my heart, just like Stowe does, just like Akron Law. I'm a local girl.
Yeah. And what was your father a professor of?
Geography and statistics, you know, the types of things that I'm good at, but I didn't pursue because I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't follow it. So
I concur on my own behalf.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, again, that's just an amazing story. Was it the position as the clerk in Aurora that that made you want to go into law?
So interestingly enough, I thought I wanted to go to law early on because my mother's a lawyer, and I had abandoned that, and I had decided once I was in Aurora, I thought I was just going to go and get an English PhD, and I was going to be a professor in nationalist literature. And while I was in Aurora, I started to see a dynamic that that I felt that we needed to try to give quality legal representation to people who maybe otherwise couldn't afford it. So what would happen is when you deal with city government, a lot of times you're dealing with public monies, and the public may end up in a legal battle, whether legitimate or not, with residents. And I was watching residents spend, you know, $50,000 a year, and the city spending $200,000 a year on legal services. And I was like, wow, you know, even though they're involved in litigation, that's a big disparity, you know, the whole deep pockets theory, right? So I decided then that I wanted to go to law school because I wanted to be able to provide people who otherwise couldn't afford quality legal representation with the same type of representation that the deep pockets could get, but at an affordable price. And so, yes, it led me to going to law school. It was kind of maybe not a direct lead, but it led me to want to continue to help people on a legal perspective.
Yeah. So did you run for office before? I mean, I know you were appointed magistrate, but had you run for office prior to what you're doing right now?
No, this is my first time. I had a primary in this election. So this particular position is my first time running, but I did run in the primary race this March that got extended till April 28th. And for that, it was a primary, and we ended up winning with 64% of the vote.
Yeah. I remember it well.
Yeah, you were there.
That was there. Awesome. So tell me about the race so far. Obviously, people are very attuned to politics right now because there's an important national election. And there are a few key county races, yours being one, that I think for some voters at least may not be very high up on their list of importance, even though they are very important positions. So I'm curious to hear about the state of the race for you, what's been happening since the primary, since you've been the Democratic nominee for this seat.
So the primary, needless to say, was stressful and drawn out. We thought we were going to hear results after March 17th, which was the original date of the election, and it was extended until April 28th. And after that, we all had to deal with trying to campaign during a pandemic, which was new for everyone, except maybe me and a couple other people who had campaigned during the primary. And so essentially now I'm currently running against Katarina Cook, who is currently a judge on the court. The seat that we're both running for is an open seat. Judge John Quinn, who is a Democrat, is retiring. And that leaves an open seat on the court, which basically means there is no incumbent. There is nobody who is running for re-election for that seat. And so both Katarina Cook and I are vying for that seat. The difference, though, however, and a unique situation is that she's currently a judge on the court and she's running for the opposite position on the same court. So there's only two judges on the court. So if I win this election, that means that the voters would have chosen who their next domestic relations judge would be. So Judge Quinn would be gone. It would be Katarina Cook and Connie Hightower. However, if she wins the race, then that means that the governor would then, she would create a vacancy, and then the governor would appoint that vacancy. And so essentially what that means is if she wins, it would be Katarina Cook and an unknown. Nobody would know at the day of the election. Nobody would know after the election. And the governor then, or Governor DeWine, then has the ability to appoint somebody to that seat somebody who we don't know, who didn't run, who we know nothing about. And that's really what causes the uniqueness of my race. It's not me versus my opponent. It's more me versus an unknown opponent that gets to be selected by the governor, not the voters.
Yeah, in some ways, it's almost like voter suppression. Like, you create a situation where the voters don't get a say in who that judge is if Katerina is to win.
Well, I mean, I think you're exactly right. Whether it's voter suppression or voter confusion, or, you know, I won't go as so far as to say deception, because I think that if you ask her, she will tell you. In fact, we had a candidates night in Stowe, and where she did admit and say, yes, if I win, then their governor will appoint somebody. And then eventually down the line, the public could appoint them. But either way, so I don't think that if the question is asked that there's deception there. It's just people believe that when you see a judge's name on the ballot, that person is running for re-election. And so you're completely right. When somebody is voting and that person does not vote for who will actually be the judge, the next judge on the court serving with her, then it does kind of suppress that, because their vote doesn't count. Their vote counts so that she gets another 6 years on her term, but their vote doesn't count to get to say who they want, because the governor appoints them. And then eventually down the line, maybe 1 or 2 years later, there's an election.
It's not even just that the governor appoints the person who will take that seat. It's that the Republican Party in the county will select someone via precinct committee persons, and then that person would be recommended to the governor as the appointee, correct?
So I'm not sure of the exact process. I just know that it is the local Republican Party. So the Summit County Republican Party would make a recommendation, 1, 2, 3. I'm not sure how many they make to the governor. And then the governor has to choose. But that would mean then that one whole party, you know, right now when we look at the election, these are, you know, we've got nonpartisan people, we've got Democrats, and we've got Republicans, and we've got people of various other parties, you know, Green Party and things like that, who are voting. And so that would leave then one party the opportunity to hand select who they wanted and then recommend whoever they wanted to the governor to choose from, you know. And so would that person be a Democrat or a nonpartisan or from another party? Highly unlikely. Which would then mean that one party would have the ability to elevate certain people for the governor's selection. And those people would not be chosen by the voters.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels underhanded, right? I mean, it just doesn't seem right.
Well, look, if I could be candid.
Please.
I agree with you. Not only does it not seem right, I feel it's an abuse of the process. It's an abuse of the system. I feel it's unfair to the voters. And I feel that it's a lack of transparency to the voters. The voters should never believe that they're going to elect somebody. The judges are nonpartisan for the primaries because they want you to choose the best person. And so in this, you're not necessarily choosing the best person when you're comparing the candidates, because you're not aware that your choice of one could result in an appointment. You know, also, judges are elected to represent or to be public servants to a certain area. You know, in this case, it's all of Summit County. And so if we're elected for that and our service is to serve these people on the court to the best of our ability, that's not necessarily, if we're running for an opposite position in order to get an appointment or to have our party appoint the next person, that's not really serving the residents. You know, when we look at what the legislature has passed in terms of judges, they want judges to be nonpartisan in the general because they don't want politics infused. And this is a way to infuse politics. They also create these terms, these 6-year terms, for a reason, not so that every single judge who is in the middle of a term will run for another term if there's a governor of the same party. You know, and finally, they want us to be able to serve our dockets and to serve those people for a certain period of time and to earn that reelection. And all of this flies in the face of the purpose of the legislature and flies in the face of what we expect for the integrity of our judicial races. It should not be allowed.
Yeah. And I was going to mention, for all my, you know, objections to this situation, we did in Cuyahoga Falls in 2019 have an at-large councilman, Councilman Gorbach, who already held an at-large seat, run for an open at-large seat that was vacated by another councilman. Councilman Gorbach was running for an open at-large seat, and if he were to win that at-large seat, he would move from his existing council seat to this other at-large seat, and that would give the Democrats the power to appoint someone to the remainder of his term in the at-large seat. And we ended up with Councilman Russ Balthus as a result of that process. I know that myself and Democrats and probably Republicans to a certain extent are happy with Councilman Balthus because he was the law director of our city and just a really impressive young man, if I may say so, because he's a little younger than me. but this is what is happening with this with your race. If the Republican is to win, is the same thing that happened on a council race in Cuyahoga Falls with an at-large council seat. Talk to me about the difference there, because you made mention of it before we were recording.
Well, okay. So first of all, there's a great difference between the two. When you look at, as a council clerk, I served 9 councilmen for 6.5 years. And if you look at the dynamics of city council, a city council person, whether at large or whether representative of a ward, is representing a group of people to whom that person directly answers and to whom that person brings the issues to the city for resolution. So whoever it was who was in place before this all happened, they would have had a constituents that they would have talked to and that they would have brought the issues or helped the city resolve the issues for those particular people. When you look at what the function of a judge is, it's completely different. And this is why judicial candidates have a whole set of rules. Our rules for judges and judicial candidates who are running for office are completely different than all of the other types of offices that are running. We have a completely different set of rules because they want us to remain impartial. They also want us to understand that when we are serving from the bench, we are addressing the laws, we are adjudicating the laws, and we are making decisions regardless of race, color, creed, sex, sexual orientation. So we're elected by a body from Summit County, let's say, for this particular position I'm running for. But our goal, our job once we are elected, is to fairly issue decisions which are in line with the laws and the Constitution, and not to push or promulgate the agenda or the questions of any one constituent. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So there's a complete difference in the roles of a council person versus a judge. Another difference is that council people are on our ballots and they are partisan on our ballots, which means that when Russ Balthus runs again, it's gonna say he's a Democrat, you know, or it's gonna say that somebody is a Republican, or I believe it will. I'm not quite sure on Cuyahoga Falls. But in Akron and many of the surrounding communities and on county council for Summit, it will tell you their party designation so that you have an understanding of which political affiliation that person is with. When you come to judicial candidates, we'll have partisan primaries, but the general election does not list our party and our political affiliation so that people can do the research and they can see the difference, because they do want fairness and impartiality. When you are tied to a certain party, particularly on the general election ballot, then that begins to breed concern with others on what your politics are and what your point of view are. They want us to remain impartial. And so it's a completely different circumstance for judges who are litigating over dockets and who are issuing decisions for the residents of this county.
Fair enough. although I will guess that not everyone will be convinced. But under what circumstances is everyone always convinced?
Well, I mean, here's the crazy part about it, right? Anybody who understands the dynamic of this race, but who supports the appointment of an unknown person by the governor to be a judge, to make decisions, when you don't know that person, you don't know where they're coming from, you don't know their temperament on the court, you don't know their practice, you don't know how they've treated people, for anybody to support that, then they are strictly supporting a partisan appointment, because we should have the right to know who is going to be presiding over our courts, period.
Yeah, I totally agree. So, with all that in mind, then, we've talked about your background. We've talked about sort of the state of the race. Can you tell us about kind of your pitch for your campaign? Why you think you'd be the best judge for this seat, apart from the kind of inequity that's, you know, that could potentially arise from, you know, the possibility of there being an appointment to this seat?
Okay, so setting aside the fact that we're really not comparing Judge Cook's qualifications to mine, because it's really me versus an unknown, some of the things that I bring to this bench is I've been a practicing attorney for 12 years. I've also been a law professor. During my time, especially in my practice of law, I have represented people in sometimes some of their worst. I've seen clients lose their children. I've seen clients pass away. I've seen clients on drug addictions, all types of things that people in the general public may not even understand that we see as attorneys. I've also seen the flip of it. I've seen the positive. I've seen people rehab. I've seen families come back together, children being returned to their parents. So I've seen the whole dynamic of this county. And one of the things that I can say is our county is stressed. I've seen the mental stress of my clients and what personal stress has caused them, losing jobs, having issues, having to raise children, financial issues, as well as what the court system stress has caused them. And so when you look at domestic relations court, we have the ability to touch more than 50% of the population, more people than any other court in this county. And so when you think of how many people you know, or anybody else, 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 people we know have gone through divorce or child support or legal custody or civil protection orders, the things that come under domestic relations court. With that being said, when we have a stressed community, this court has a captive audience of being able to help repair some of the damage and stress in Summit County. So some of the ways that I see us doing that is, number one, we have to be able to have a holistic approach to being able to help our families. And what that means is we look at their current issues, but we also look at all of these issues funneling in, which are causing us some stress. And we try to release that bottleneck. We offer programs such as divorce mediation. So when we look at children, a psychologist once told me that children of divorce and disillusion and child fights go through PTSD the longer that the case goes on. We have an opportunity to be able to help some of these children from having long-term problems by shortening case duration or addressing ways that we can insulate the children from these cases. Divorce mediation is one of them. If they can avoid a long drawn out 2 to 3 year divorce with their parents and parents can agree on something, then they can work together so that they can protect the children because the children love them both. We also can do early intervention programs. So we have SERPs, generational cycles that we see, and I'm sure you've seen them, Alex, like they go from generation to generation, maybe domestic violence versus unemployment or just various things that children witness from their parents and then pass down to their own children. And those types of generational cycles are often the product of people not being able to use resources or having those resources brought to them or having that intervention. And so I intend on also helping the court to break those generational cycles. And I might be a dreamer. When we put all of that together, we can, at least as the court system, start to relieve some of the stresses that this court may cause and bring the community back to the public, in addition to with community outreach services. And so I'm looking at a phenomenal, holistic approach to saving our county, saving our children, saving our future generations, and also making this court basically not as stressful as it currently is.
Well, you know, I think that you have brought, I mean, I have to say, you have brought a lot of things to light in this conversation about this particular position. I know that, you know, we're saying at the county level, vote all the way down.
Biden to Betty and Harris to Hightower.
And it almost makes it seem as though your race is at the bottom. But to hear you talk about it, I think it's absolutely clear that this is a very important position and we should have a qualified person in it. And we should have a person who we know, which is exactly, I think, your pitch as far as not allowing the Republicans to put somebody who voters don't approve into that seat. So I certainly appreciate Yeah, I certainly appreciate your time and what you have and your having enlightened us all. So thank you so much for joining us and for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here and I appreciate your time as well. And remember to vote on or before November 3rd, Hightower for Domestic Relations Judge.
There you have it. Okay, we're back on the Fallscast with our second interview of this episode, something we haven't done before, but this being our last episode before Election Day 2020, we wanted to take this opportunity to introduce our listeners to some of the candidates. And today we're lucky to have with us Mr. Matt Shaughnessy, a lawyer, former firefighter, former police officer, Green City Councilman, who ran for mayor in 2019 of Green, and who is now running for the state House of Representatives in the 36th District, which covers Cuyahoga Falls in large part, as well as a number of other communities. So we're really lucky to have Mr. Shaughnessy here with us today. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you, Alex.
It is our pleasure, of course. We want to give our listeners a perspective on who you are as a candidate, but we always like to talk to our interviewees about their past, their story, how they got to where they are. So we could start there. Are you originally from Green or the Northeast Ohio area?
No, yes, Northeast Ohio, certainly. Grew up in Lakewood, Ohio for most of my life. Grew up in a family of eight. My mom was a teacher and a chemist, and my father worked at the Chevy plant. And they had six children. I was the kind of in the middle. Had a great childhood in Lakewood growing up. My dream was to be a firefighter. I know you kind of introduced that a little bit going in, and I wanted to be a firefighter growing up when I was in high school, and so I pursued civil service tests to become a firefighter. If anyone's listening and wants to be one, you take a civil service test and they hire you based on those test results. So I took as many as I could. And there's not much difference between a civil service test for fire department and police department. So I was taking both, and Cleveland offered me a job. And, you know, not knowing what your future says, I took it.
Cleveland offered you a job as a police officer.
As a police officer. Yes. Yes. Thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah.
And I took it. It was a great experience. Worked with a lot of great people, men and women. Within a year, though, I switched over to fire. I was offered a job at the Fairview Park Fire Department. I had taken enough tests and got high enough on those lists, luckily, that I was, the job offers were starting to come in. So I switched over to Fairview Fire and served there. Absolutely enjoyed it. I lived my dream and I was lucky for it. You know, it's a position where you get to earn a living, raise a family, and do what's probably the most important thing you can do, and that's help other people. And so I consider myself extremely lucky. You know, sometimes people will say, "Oh, thank you for your service," you know, and to me it always sounds odd because I think I walked away taking more than I gave, in the sense that, you know, it's so rewarding, such a rewarding career. You know, I would do it all over again if I could.
Yeah. But were you like a little kid that played with fire trucks and stuff? I mean, I'm just imagining.
Well, yes. We didn't have, you know, the forearm building muscle building Xbox controllers back then. So we had Tonka trucks and fire trucks too. But we did a lot of, kids just don't do what we do. I'm 55 years old, and we had some great times having acorn fights, picking up acorns and throwing them at each other. You know, and we had rules to these acorn fights. You weren't allowed to throw buckeyes. You know, we had some buckeye trees in the area and pick up buckeyes. Now they're a lot heavier and harder. Acorns will sting, you know, but buckeyes will those will put a welt on you.
Acorns got that little needle on the bottom of them if you're not, you know.
Right. But the bigger ones, they occasionally got into the mix. But then, of course, we'd cry foul and, you know. I'm not sure exactly how a lot of those ended, but we had a lot of fun anyway.
Who can remember anyway? So you were a firefighter for a while, and then what came next?
Well, I did a career as a firefighter, and then I left there and went to the University of Akron. I took a job as a real estate coordinator, project manager, where I helped with the their stadium project.
Oh, wow.
And while there, I went to law school at night. And I always wanted to be an attorney at some point in my life. I think the spark for that happened in the police academy. Learning the laws, it just seemed to come natural to me. And I really enjoyed it. So I went to law school. At night, got my law degree and opened up my own practice, and I helped crime victims under the Ohio Crime Victims Act. The Ohio Crime Victims Act provides money to victims of violent crime for things like lost wages, medical expenses that aren't covered by insurance. Every state has one of these, and Ohio's is a pretty good one. It offers up to $50,000 for crime victims to recover for their losses, and it's needed because a lot of victims of crime, they have nowhere else to turn. When they're out of work, they're out of work. And you and I, we all pay for it. We all pay for it through anytime you get a speeding ticket, $9 of that speeding ticket goes into the crime victims fund. So if you ever get pulled over, feel a little better, you're doing some good for crime victims when you pay that fee.
I, of course, have never had a speeding ticket in my life.
Really? No. Oh, well, then you're not contributing.
No, that's a total joke. I've had a few.
Okay. Me too.
Can you give me an example of something, I mean, without talking about a specific case, I suppose, where a crime victim benefited from this fund?
Gosh, there's just lots of crime victims, unfortunately, that benefit from the fund. I can't speak to specifics, but I can give you some stats that I kind of hold in my head. The average pay award for crime victims is around $2,400.
So maybe like if somebody gets like their house robbed or something, and they catch the guy who did it, and then that person's able to get almost like restitution through the fund. Is it that? Is that kind of?
Yes and no. There has to be a threat of physical harm. So it has to be a violent crime.
Okay.
So if somebody breaks into your garage, steals your lawnmower, it doesn't apply. But if somebody assaults you on the street, your glasses fall off, they get smashed, it'll pay for your glasses. If you miss a day of work, if you have to go to court to testify against that person and you miss a day of work, this program will cover that. So it's really a great program. Not a lot of people know about it, and it's my job to get that information out there along with the states.
That's awesome. And so that's what you're still doing now, is practicing law in order to help victims of violent crime take advantage of this program.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. And so at what point then did you decide, I mean, I assume Green City Council was your first foray into politics. Am I right about that?
Yes. In 2018, I started 2018. So I decided in 2017 that I wanted to get involved in politics. And I did it because, I've always been politically minded, but I've just never had the time in my life to pursue running for political office. And I just saw some things happening in our town that I kind of disagreed with. And I thought, well, I think I can do more than just disagree. I think I can be part of the solutions, hopefully. So I decided to run for council. Was in a three-person race and just worked really hard, knocked on knocked on every door. In fact, some people were saying, you were here 2 months ago. So I got around to a couple of them twice. And I ended up winning that race. And it was very exciting. And I've learned quite a bit. It's a lot of hard work.
So then fast forward 1 year, you've been on council for a year, and you think to yourself, you know, I could lead this city. How did it go?
Well, so I and a few other council members, we had some disagreements with our mayor. You know, he's a fine guy. We just think that the city should go in a different direction. And the other two council members, they were not going to run. And I thought, well, it's up to me. I might as well give it a go. I think we can do a lot of good here in the city. So I decided to run for mayor. I knew it was a David versus Goliath thing, you know.
David versus Goliath in the sense that, I mean, Green is very Republican, or at least historically has been, right?
Yeah, more than one David Goliath situation. It was I'm a Democrat, and my opponent is a Republican. Although in Green, we're nonpartisan, but when it comes to mayor, people find out and people want to know.
Right.
So they find out if they go in and they're voting, and they're a Republican or they're a Democrat, they've already found out. If they're an independent, well, it didn't matter to them anyway. You know. So. It does come into play, but it's not officially on the ballot. But it was that, but it was also, you know, I was a freshman council member, and you know, going against an incumbent mayor. So that's the other David Goliath matchup there. It's a hard thing to do. So I knew that going in. I knew I had to work really, really hard, and that's what I did. Again, knocked on doors, but this time I had to knock on, instead of one-fourth of the city, all the city. I think I got to them all. I might have missed a few, but it was a lot of work. In the end, I came up 187 votes shy, and that's 90, you know, I like to say it, 94 the other way, and I would have been there. But that wasn't in the cards. So I am not mayor. I'm still on city council and now running for state house. I was going to talk a little bit about the importance of voting with that.
Sure.
When I look at those numbers and I say 94 would have changed it the other way. Well, 94, when you break that down, there's 20 precincts in the city of Green. A precinct is a group of voters. It's roughly in Green about 520 that vote at a specific location. And if there was just five votes in each precinct the other way, that would be the election, you know. So it's very important that everyone get out there and vote, you know, for any election. Doesn't matter who you're voting for.
Absolutely. I heard a similar statistic about the 2016 election, that if there had been just a certain, just a few votes per precinct in certain states, that we would have President Clinton right now.
Absolutely. Yes.
So, I was going to say, I mean, you know, I've heard some people complain that, sort of modern politics, have produced this situation in which, in the old days, you might think of politics as being like, you know, somebody runs for political office because they have some issue, maybe their kid, you know, wants to do something in the city and they can't do it because there's something missing from the city, or there's some like screwy policy and they get upset and they think to themselves, well, I'm going to run because I want to change that. Whereas, you know, now, while that still exists, there's also quite a bit of the kind of political science politics, if you will, which is like, you know, people who actually go to college with an eye toward political science and with the intention of coming out of college and serving in public office. So it's a lot more sort of a scientific, direct approach to politics. And so it sounds like you're sort of more in the old school in terms of, you know, why you originally thought to run. And that's,
yes,
that's nice. So,
yeah, I'm definitely old school. And I think one of the main things, that made me want to run is priorities. I see a lot of times, what elected officials do, they get excited about new stuff, stuff they can put their name on. And, you know, on, let's say on a local level, I want to see the things we have maintained. You know, I want our walkways to be in good shape. I want our benches to be, you know, standing true. You know, that just small detail stuff. You keep everything neat, clean, tidy, and in good shape. People will be happy. And that's kind of how I was approaching my race for mayor. And it's kind of how I approach everything. You know, let's take care of what we have, and then look to the shiny future. You know, let's not let things fall apart and only focus on new things.
For sure. And I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of good people who run for office for a lot of different reasons, even if they are just political science majors or disgruntled, you know, residents or whatever it is. It's good to have a mixed bag, so to speak, to get a lot of different perspectives. And I think that's part of what's important about democracy, obviously. Right. So,
yes, absolutely.
So you're now running for the State House of Representatives.
Yes.
In the 36th district, which of course includes a large part of Cuyahoga Falls. What are the other communities that you would serve in the 36th district?
The Talmadge, Lakemoor, Mogador, Springfield, Coventry, and the city of Green.
Awesome. And so, how has the campaign been going? I mean, there obviously are the Falls Free Press. We have some insight into how the race is going. We could talk about that in a moment, but, how have you been proceeding and how's it going?
Well, it's a lot of work. Remember when I said there was a lot of work running for council and then for mayor? Well, running for mayor was four times the people that I had to run for council against, and running for this is five times more than for mayor. So just getting the messaging out, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, and unfortunately, it costs money too to get that messaging out. So the campaign has been, I think, good. We had some polling in early September that showed us tied at the time. It was 37-37 with 26% undecided. So there's still a lot of people out there to get votes from. So we've been working very hard. I think it looks good. You just never know. You just never know. We don't have any updated polling, as polling costs money. They have to call, you know, roughly 600 people to get information from. So that's, as you can imagine, it's not an easy task or a cheap task.
Absolutely. And then right in the middle of all this, things have kind of gone crazy at the State House. Because we had a Republican speaker who was engaged in, I think they said, the largest bribery scheme in the Ohio State history.
Yes.
Larry Householder, who was taking money from the First Energy Corporation in order to develop some nuclear plants that were connected to that corporation. What's your take on all that, and how is it affecting your race?
Well, it does have a direct effect on my race. As you know, Larry Householder, he was taking money from First Energy, and in order to stack the deck in his favor, he was giving that money to, amongst other things, you know, amongst giving it to himself, as the FBI alleges, he was giving it to candidates in order to help them win. And in turn, those candidates would vote for him as Speaker of the House. And this is in the FBI report, he gave leadership positions to what they refer to as Team Householder. leadership positions that are held by Tony DeVitas, who sits in this seat right now. He's leaving, and I think there were some protests at his business, but he was given a lot of money from Householder and First Energy, and he never gave it back. He never gave it to a charity. But what he did do was he gave it to Bob Young, my opponent. So this Householder money has moved over to my opponent, and I believe he was a team Householder. You know, Householder was always looking to the future. There are a number of Householder candidates out there right now running for office. You know, yeah, he was going to keep that pipeline going as long as he could. If it wasn't for the FBI.
So is it, do we have, I mean, are they Householder candidates, as you say, because we can tell from their campaign reports that they took money directly from him, or are there other people involved, or?
The money didn't go directly. That's the thing about the Householder money. He was moving it from place to place. It was a giant shell game. But he moved it to, people like Jay Edwards, who's a House member and has a leadership position. He gave Bob Young $13,000. He moved it to DeVitas. DeVitas gave Bob Young $10,000. It was like a shell game. It wasn't a direct transfer. But you know, you can read the tea leaves. You know. There's no sense pulling the wool over your own eyes, you know, when it's right there in front of you. So we, you know, that's something that I'm dealing with. That's something that other candidates are also dealing with, this huge influx of money, you know, that's remnants of Householder.
Has your opponent faced any backlash over the Householder money at all that you know of, or?
I don't know how much, you know, again, we would need polling to know, you know, how that affects how a particular situation affects a candidate. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say. I certainly hope Ohioans and people of District 36 are fed up with corruption, culture of corruption in the Ohio House, and want to see a change. You know, but it's hard to say how it is truly affected.
Yeah. And of course, your opponent has had some other controversies as well. In fact, one of which we actually reported on. We received some information. The False Free Press that included a police report, a couple of different fire reports, all kind of pointing to this idea that there was an arson that was committed allegedly. On the business that was owned by Bob Young in Talmadge. Essentially, it looked as though it didn't look as though. I mean, the fire department in Talmadge filed a police report alleging that arson was the cause of the fire at a building that Mr. Young is in a contract deed, which is to say a land contract, to purchase. So he's, for all intents and purposes, the owner, but I mean, he doesn't own the building outright. He's, you know, making payments to somebody in order to take over ownership of the property. Well, that property burned down, and the Talmadge firefighters filed a police report saying that they believed arson was the cause. And because of that police report, the police then initiated a subpoena from the city of Greene to get records from a fire that happened in 2014 at a building in Greene that was also owned by Mr. Young, where there was a cause that was basically they couldn't figure out exactly what caused the fire after an investigation. So, you know, we published an article about this, and we never got any response from Mr. Young until after we published the article. We received sort of a demand for retraction through a lawyer and an affidavit. He says he was cooperating with the investigation. He disputed that we said he was the owner of the building because he's in a land contract. So, you know, he's not the owner of the building the same way I don't own my house because I have a mortgage, just more or less.
right. That's actually such a silly argument. I mean, I am a lawyer, and I can't imagine a judge in the world would differentiate between somebody owning something by land contract or owning something through a mortgage.
Yeah,
it's silly.
And we did update the article based on the information that he provided, because we genuinely wanted to hear from him about his perspective on the issue, but he had not responded. So we did update that. So if you go to thefallsfreepress.com, you can see the article in its updated form. Nevertheless, there was a police report filed by the firefighters who believed that this building had caught fire due to arson. Now, whether or not Bob Young went down there with some kind of an accelerant and himself lit the match, of course, we don't know, and we're not saying he did that. But this did happen in the middle of your campaign. Do you want to talk about that? Because that's we just found that to be crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's quite the contrast. You know, you've got a guy who's apparently he's under investigation for an arson, and it's not his first fire. Like you say, he had a fire in Green in 2014. I don't know about you, but how many fires do you have? So anyhow, retired firefighter versus guy under investigation. I've talked with firefighters. I know more about this story. Bob Young knows there's more to the story, and he needs to come clean. I'm not going to say anything that I can't verify in a document. So I'm just going to have to leave it at that, except that the documents do speak for themselves. You know, here's Talmadge police are subpoenaed, you know, used a court-ordered subpoena to get records on his first fire. So that speaks volumes as to what's going on in that open investigation. So I'll leave it at that. You know, it's upsetting to me as a firefighter seeing in the report, the fire report, that a Talmadge firefighter was injured. Now, I don't know the extent of that, but it's in the report that one was injured.
We actually looked into that, and the fire department did respond to us and tell us that it was a minor laceration that was treated, and he didn't have to go to the hospital or anything like that. But
okay, good. That's good to hear. But still, you know, it's that you know, having you know, if this turns out to be a situation where it was intentionally set, which they believe, you know, it's very upsetting. It's very concerning to me as a firefighter, and it should be to anybody. But I guess I'll leave it at that, because I can't speak to the things I've heard that are not in documents. I should not do that.
For sure. Looking then toward next week, you must be antsy. You must be signing a lot of postcards, trying to get people who are receiving mail-in ballots to fill in the bubble next to your name.
Yes, and return them. Yes, absolutely.
There was a report in the newspaper that said that the number of mail-in ballots this year, I think, as opposed to 2016, I think it was 2016. It could be last year, but in any case, the number of mail-in ballots was up 60% from then. So. You must have a lot of hand cramps signing these postcards, getting people to return their ballots.
Oh, yes. We've been sending out a ton of postcards. It's a ton of work. A lot have returned them. There's still a lot of ballots out there. Now, I don't know if they've been filled out yet and just sitting in an envelope waiting to go. But I think people should not trust the mail, even though, you know, that's such a weird thing to say. Don't trust the mail. Get your ballot out early. You know, I guess what I really want to say is don't trust what's going on. You know, the politics in Washington, it's all about stopping the mail, stopping the voting. You know, let's not trust that. Let's trust the men and women who deliver our mail. But boy, they're making their job hard. And but let's get them in early. You know, getting them in early is going to help them, help the men and women who deliver the mail accomplish their goal, which is to get those ballots to the Board of Elections on time.
Yeah. And so I guess maybe the last thing is just, you know, we would ask kind of, you know, what's your pitch? What are you hoping to do when you get to the state house? You know, why do you want to be in the state house? What are you telling voters when they ask you why they should vote for you? Those kinds of things.
Well, gosh, you know, it's so funny because when, before the, in the primary, we didn't have the coronavirus. It seems like a year ago, you know, and then it was about, you know, returning Ohio to its, to the times when people wanted to come to Ohio. You know, people have been leaving Ohio. That's why we're losing Senate seats, or not, I'm sorry, not Senate seats. We're losing House of Representatives seats because the jobs just aren't here. So in a big way, that hasn't changed. We need to attract good paying jobs, union jobs, new energy jobs. And the one thing that kind of bugs me about that, saying the new energy job, it almost sounds like a platitude, because Ohio politicians in general have been saying it, but they have not been pursuing it. In fact, they've been doing things to make it not happen. So we need to actually make it happen in Ohio. Bring the jobs. The jobs are everything. Once the jobs are here, the communities flourish, the schools do better, and it becomes a state where people want to come and live. It's a great state. It's very affordable to live here now. I see no reason why we're not at, you know, the edge of takeoff here. We can do some great things in Ohio, and I that's what I want to do. But since COVID, the message has changed. We need to open up our economy, but we need to do it safely. And, you know, playing this mask game, the revolving mask game, we're doing it on a local level in Ohio. We're doing it on whatever you want to call it, a hodgepodge way across the nation. It's not working, and we're seeing the numbers right now as we have an explosion. We do need to open up, but we need to open up safely, and we know how to do that, and that's with masks. And in the meantime, until we get a true handle on this, we need to support our small businesses, our restaurants, the tour operators, stuff like that, the businesses that just, they're just too risky to run right now. I know the restaurants are open, but they're, you know, they're doing 25% of what they did. Nobody can manage that way for long. So those are priorities right now.
Yeah, people don't think about like theaters and clubs.
Oh,
like
yeah.
I'm one of my avocations is being a musician, and I haven't been able to perform inside of a club but one time since the coronavirus.
Yeah, you probably lost a lot of gigs, and that matters.
It does. And for, I mean, you know, in my case, like, again, it's an avocation, but for a lot of people who I have performed with over the years, music is their life. It's their bread and butter. They perform every weekend and all through the week with a variety of bands, and they give lessons, and all of those are things that generally people do in person. And although lessons can be given, you know, via Zoom or whatever, you know, there are also not as many ways to continue to perform music live. And so a lot of people are just doing sort of like online streams and stuff. We talked about this in our podcast last week, but it's not easy to make money doing that, and certainly not going to provide enough money to keep things going. So there are some initiatives that are going to try and help music venues and places like that. But I wanted to ask you, what's your opinion of Governor Mike DeWine?
It's a little mixed. Okay. I applaud that he is taking a action against COVID early and against his party, specifically the House Republicans, who have who have looked to impeach him. They've looked to have him charged with crimes. I mean, it's just bizarre what's going on in the House, and so that's another reason to make some changes over there. I'll tell you that. But I think he wavered a little bit early on, where he didn't impose masks requirements, even though I'm pretty sure that was in his heart to do that. And he wavered because the House Republicans again were just relentless going after him and the health director. What they did is just disgusting. What they did to the health director, chased her out. Just terrible. And who suffers? The people. You know, we have additional deaths in the state because of what they did. But as far as DeWine handling this, we could have done a lot worse. That's for sure.
Yes, absolutely. We would be remiss if we did not mention that in the primary, which, as you mentioned, was kind of a cluster because of the coronavirus having extended the deadline and really kind of gaslighted the candidates in a certain way. If we didn't mention that you had an opponent who was a Cuyahoga Falls local, and I think it's appropriate to talk about that in part because, you know, the seat in the 36th district has long been sought by Democrats. We had Paul Colavecchio at one time run for that seat, and he was unsuccessful. We had a young man named Noah Spinner who ran in the primary. I believe it was 2016, or was it 2018? Mm-hmm. Maybe 20. I can't remember which. And he was unsuccessful in the primary. But then we had a gentleman who I believe is from Canton, Mr. Tim Pyatt, who sought that seat and was unsuccessful in the election. And now, as you mentioned, Anthony DeVitas, who's well known locally and is actually running for county council now that he's term limited in the state house. In spite of his connections to Larry Householder and the corruption in the state house, Mr. DeVitas is term limited. And so it's you, versus Bob Young now, but prior to it being you versus Bob Young, it was you versus AJ Harris, who is a Cuyahoga Falls native and, pretty popular here.
Yeah, great guy.
What's your thinking about the primary in hindsight and the race with, AJ?
Well, AJ is new to politics. He's a great guy. Have all respect for him. And believe me, I was taken to task with AJ and his campaign. He did some things that was just really, really good as far as a campaign goes. He built a team early. He built a strong team. And they executed a good plan. I obviously had to react and worked hard on my end, and had to just send out messaging to people as to what I want to do. And it boils down, I think, to which campaign was more effective getting their messaging out. I think that's the ultimate decider in this situation. We had two great candidates, I think. I know AJ was a great candidate. I'll leave that answer up to the voters for me. But I think that's what it came down to, was just the effect of the messaging between the two candidates. I think we have an awful lot in common. We see things the same way on a whole host of issues. So I think the people will be well served, whoever they would have gotten. I am just fortunate to have moved on past the primary.
Yeah, and I mean, we should mention that AJ is a class act. He did
absolutely.
After suffering a loss that I think was a surprise, because he was very popular in Cuyahoga Falls, at least. He did losing an election is difficult. It's hard.
Yes.
It's devastating. But he did come out pretty shortly thereafter and endorse your campaign, and I know you have his full support. So,
And that's been very helpful, and I thank him for that. And I'm looking forward to seeing the things that he does in the future. He's an incredible talent. He's got some great ideas, and I look forward to whatever he does and supporting him in that.
Absolutely. Well, man, we want to thank you so much for coming on the FallsCast and telling us your story and giving us your pitch. We wish you well. We wish you luck. We will see you next year when you are State Representative Matt Shaughnessy.
Thank you. If that happens, I'll have a celebratory acorn fight, because it is fall and all the acorns are dropping and you're invited.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to wear eye protection now.
That's right. Yeah, we didn't have that back then. But I think it's probably mandatory now.
All right. I'll pick all the Buckeyes then.
There you go.
All right, man. Well, thanks a lot again, and we will talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
FallsCast is a production of the Falls Free Press in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Please check out the Falls Free Press at fallsfreepress.com or on social media at facebook.com/fallsfreepress or @falls_free on Twitter or Instagram. We thank you for listening to this episode, which was recorded and edited by Alex Hall. Please subscribe to our podcast and tell your Cuyahoga Falls friends and family so that they can listen as well.